So today I will tell you about analog simulation of quantum field theories with quantum circuits. And in particular, I will focus on the quantum Sine-Gordon model. So I want to begin with the pioneering thought of Feynman when he asked the question, what kind of computer are we going to use to simulate physics? And here the basic idea was that nature is inherently quantum mechanical. And so any efficient simulation of nature must therefore also be quantum mechanical. And the fundamental problem, as we all know it, is the exponentially large Hilbert space of a quantum many-body problem that is difficult to manipulate on a classical computing machine. And it is with this in mind that he said that you can simulate this with a quantum system with quantum computer elements. It is not a Turing machine, but a machine of a different kind. And in this sense, quantum simulation is one of the most native applications of quantum information science. And one of the most natural implications are in quantum chemistry, in the simulation of complex molecules. Then quantum simulation is also crucial for quantum field theory, and I will show you some examples today. And because of its ability to manipulate large Hilbert spaces, it's useful and important for condensed matter and statistical mechanics in general. Now, there are two ways to do quantum simulation. The first is a digital approach. In this approach, one uses a universal quantum computer to simulate. And here, the price of universality is very steep because it needs the implementation of quantum error correcting codes. And while there is a lot of research going on actively in this in the field right now, but the final goal is still some distance away. And so here we can take a more near-term approach, which is that of analog quantum simulation, where we simulate a specific quantum system by tailoring a specific another. And so here the trade-off is universality for near-term achievability, because this approach does not require implementing quantum error-correcting codes. Of course, there will be defects in our simulators, and so what this will give rise to is detrimental quality of data. However, this is something that's true for any experimental realization. And what is really exciting about this is that there is a wide range of platforms that are available for this. And so we can now ask the question, what kind of analog simulator are we going to use? And here, the first and foremost candidates are cold atoms. And so here, the cold atomic systems have now successfully simulated strongly correlated systems, topological phases, gauge theories, and so on. Then there are trapped ion simulators, which have simulated also problems in quantum magnetism and open quantum systems. And in the recent years, quantum circuits have emerged as a viable candidate for simulating impurity systems and bosonic many-body systems. Some of you may know of these quantum circuits. These are the circuits which are based on superconducting Josephson junction elements, and they are one of the leading candidates for realizing a digital quantum computer. So in that approach, you would build qubits out of these circuits. Here, I'm looking at a different side of these circuits where I want to use them as analog simulators. And the history of probing many-body physics with quantum circuits goes back a long way to Delft in the 90s. But in the recent years, there has been some kind of revolution in the fabrication and investigation of small Josephson junctions, which behave in a truly quantum mechanical manner. One of the first experiments in this domain was done in the Devoret group at Yale, where they had an array of 43 Josephson junctions. Then there was work done in the Gershenson group at Rutgers, where they had an array of 6 and another of 24 Josephson junctions. Then there was work done in the STF group in Saclay, where they had an array of about 100 Josephson junctions. Then recently in the Roch group in Grenoble, now they have arrays of 1500 junctions. And in the Manucharian group in Maryland, they now have arrays of 33,000 Josephson junctions. So you can see here, each of these vertical bars is a Josephson junction. There are 33,000 of them in the upper row. Then there is a short circuit, and there are 33,000 in the lower row. And you must understand that these are not qubits. If you would actually put 33,000 qubits together in a, on a system like this, this would not be a good idea, because each of these qubits would have their own finite lifetimes. They would decohere, and the overall system will not behave in a quantum mechanical manner. However, here, what we are trying to build is to engineer an electromagnetic impedance environment where the modes of this electromagnetic vacuum is built out of Josephson junction plasmons. What that means is that there are plasmonic excitations of this array which can interact, and this interaction can be strong because of the strong Josephson coupling. And it is this that allows us to then probe strongly interacting many-body systems. To give you a concrete idea of what I mean by these circuits and what kind of Hamiltonians, let me show you in detail what the Maryland group has realized. So I have drawn the equivalent quantum circuit below, and you will see in each unit cell, there are two circuit elements. The first is a simple element. This is the capacitor. It has charge plus and minus Q on its capacitor plates, and the Hamiltonian is Q square over 2C naught. The second term is a Josephson junction. This element is very important in this talk. You can think of this as a parallel circuit of a parallel plate capacitor and a nonlinear inductor. So the Hamiltonian now has two terms. First term comes from the electrical energy that is stored in the capacitor plates, and the second term comes from the magnetic energy that is stored in the nonlinear inductor. Then the form of this potential energy is cos phi over phi naught. Phi naught is some constant, but what is very, very important, and you must remember this, is that phi and q, they are not C numbers, but they are quantum operators, and they have a commutation relation. Now, with this knowledge, we can write down the Hamiltonian of this one-dimensional array. And the first step, we can write this Hamiltonian without disorder. So I have color-coded the different terms of the Hamiltonian, depending on which circuit element they come from. And you will see that this becomes a kind of a Bose-Hubbard model. And that's why I will also refer to the Bose-Hubbard nomenclature as I describe the different terms. So the first term, yes.
Interrupt. So in the very beginning of the talk, you said something about the exponential growth in the degrees of freedom of the system or something like that. Can you explain this?
Right. So what that means is that if you have a many-body quantum system, then with a local Hilbert space dimension, let's say D, and there are n such sites, let's say, then the Hilbert size of total size mm-hmm. of the Hilbert space grows exponentially with the number of sites. Yeah. And any generic state in this many-body system will be located in this large Hilbert space. That was what I was referring to.
So you are considering all particles which interact all with each other, right?
It can also be nearest neighbor, but I'm not restricting to ground states. I'm restricting to general states.
If you have like nearest neighbor interaction, usually your Hilbert space, like in a chain, should be just the tensor product of the Hilbert space of single particles. So why is it exponential? Just linear, right? I mean, if you have n particles, you have n Hilbert spaces with some boundary conditions. Where's the exponential part?
Maybe let's look at this Hamiltonian, this circuit. Yeah. So let's imagine that there are L sites in this circuit, and each site has a bosonic degree of freedom. So it can have the different states can be 0, 1. Think of Fock states at each site, 0, 1, 2. In this case, it actually, even the local Hilbert space is infinite, but maybe let's for definiteness say it's cut off at N. Okay. And there are L sites. So then at each site, there are N states and there are L sites. So it's n to the n times, so the total size of the Hilbert space is big, right? I mean, if you have, let's say, an array of qubits, then if you have L qubits, then the general state is a vector in the 2 to the L, right?
I get what you want to say. I mean, yes, I was thinking that you are considering already wave functions from the very beginning, which is already infinite dimensional, and then it's worse and worse. But yeah, okay, you are considering like the number of components of the matrix, basically.
Yeah, think of the density matrix. How big would it be? Yeah.
It's all and, clear. Thanks.
Okay, good. So let me get back to this Hamiltonian. So now you will see that there are different terms of the Hamiltonian that arise from different circuit elements. The first term is the term that is arising from the charging energy of this capacitor. And in the Bose-Hubbard language, it's also called on-site repulsion. And so here Ni is the excess number of Cooper pairs. So you can think of these Ni's as some kind of angular momenta, which can be both positive and negative integers. And physically, you can think that there is a superconducting island, which has a macroscopic number of Cooper pairs in the condensate. And so you can add Cooper pairs, which would correspond to increasing the Ni, but you can also remove Cooper pairs from this island, creating holes in the condensate. That's how Ni's can be both positive and negative. Then the next term...
Does it show the eigenstate?
Excuse me?
Does it show the eigenstate of this electron?
Maybe I don't understand the question.
Your audio is pretty hard to hear, but you can like type it in the chat, maybe the question.
Is it show eigenstate Ni squared?
It is the number of, so you know, if you think of maybe like Cooper pair occupations 0, 1, 2, both on positive and negative sides, then you will have eigenstates which are 0, which are plus 1, minus 1, and so on. Yes. Is that the question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so if you delete all the other terms in the Hamiltonian, then the ground state will be simply a product state at each side. Yes.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, okay. So, and then there is the next term, which comes from this capacitor in the Josephson junction, and it gives rise to a nearest neighbor repulsion. Then you could also have some kind of voltage at each node, which will give rise to a chemical potential term. And finally, there is the nearest neighbor hopping term. This is also known as the Josephson effect. What this shows is that Cooper pairs can tunnel from one superconducting island to another. And the N and the phi, they are canonically conjugate. The commutation relation is shown here. And the phase diagram of this model was analyzed before with perturbative techniques. And here we can make quantitative predictions analyzing the model with numerical techniques. And so here what we use is the density matrix renormalization group technique, where we can then chart out the phase diagram of the model. So here I'm showing you the phase diagram as a function of EJ over EC naught, which is the x-axis, and EG over EC naught, which is the y-axis. So you will see that there are insulating lobes. So these are these purple lobes, which are the Mott insulating lobes, where the density of these Cooper pairs are pinned to a certain value. Then there are also charge density wave lobes, where the system exhibits Knell-type order. And what is interesting for us is that outside these lobes in the white region, the system is described by a Luttinger liquid, where it is described by a free massless boson quantum field theory. And I will skip the details of the phase diagram, but each of these points, we understand it quite well. And so if you have questions, feel free to ask me now or after the talk. So one of the quintessential properties of this Luttinger liquid is the algebraic decay of correlations. So in this specific case, if you compute the correlation function of these operators are essentially ones that create and destroy Cooper pairs at different islands, then this correlation function exhibits an algebraic decay. And this exponent of this decay is something that is a long wavelength property of this system. It's known as the Luttinger parameter. And we can extract the correlation function and from there the Luttinger parameter quite well. And so you can see that on a log-log scale, this correlation function indeed is linear, and the slope gives us the Luttinger parameter, which is given to be 0.62. Now, this is something that while we can access numerically quite easily, but in an actual experiment, you can actually measure this by measuring transport characteristics. So, so for instance, you can couple this to another Josephson junction and so on, and then you can get this Luttinger parameter as well. Now, most experiments have disorder, and I have shown you until now a system which is free of any kind of disorder. The effect of disorder is that these lobes here, the insulating lobes, become transformed into a glassy phase. However, outside these lobes in this white region, the Luttinger liquid or the free boson phase persists. And it is this phase that has been seen in the Maryland experiment. And in the Grenoble experiment, they have gone a step further and they have coupled two such free massless boson quantum field theories to an impurity atom. So now it becomes a quantum electrodynamics problem, where now the difference is that everything is built out of Josephson junctions. The modes of electromagnetic vacuum are built out of Josephson junction plasmons, and the atom is also built out of a Josephson junction. Now you might say, what's the point of doing this? Well, the reason is that when you build the system out of Josephson junctions, you can have strong and ultra-strong coupling regimes of quantum electrodynamics, which you could not have if you were restricting yourself to what is available in nature. This is because we are no longer restricted by the fine structure constant being 1 over 137. And what I want to tell you is that we have now found that there is a whole plethora of quantum field theories that can be realized by cleverly putting together Josephson junction arrays. So this brings me to our vision, which is that of a faithful quantum circuit simulation of quantum field theories, generalizing the quantum sign Gordon model. Here, the word faithful is important because what we are interested in is to simulate the quantum field theory as accurately as possible. So when we want to simulate bosonic quantum field theories, then we want to start with bosonic lattice degrees of freedom. We don't want to start with spin chains or fermionic degrees of freedom and then do mathematical manipulations like Jordan-Wigner transformation or bosonization. This is because there are some subtle non-perturbative effects that we are interested in, which get washed away under these non-linear and non-local transformations. And the first step would be to look at generalizations of the Sine-Gordon model, which are integrable and in 1+1 space and time dimensions. The motivation to look at 1+1 space-time dimension is simply by experiments, because we have now experimental groups all throughout the world who are building these circuits. And why we look at integrable models is because they serve as ideal models to benchmark quantum simulators. And this is an important point that also is relevant for digital quantum computing. So with these quantum machines are expected to answer questions for which the answers cannot be obtained by classical methods. And so a very big part of this whole enterprise is to ensure that the answers that you are getting are indeed the correct ones. And this is where integrable models come in, since for certain observables, you can get analytical predictions. You can use these integrable models then to benchmark simulators, and then you can add integrability breaking perturbations systematically. And I will show you how to do this towards the end of the talk.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
I guess I was already tempted to ask you on the previous slide. We like, at least as far as I understood, the model you presented was essentially like an atom in an electric field, which is modeled using Josephson junctions. But then of course you could imagine like having like strong field effects and so on, where you have, I don't know, like electron pair production. And like, can this also, like, how would this be simulated with those models or equivalently? I guess my question here is, there seems to be a similar situation when you have integrable models, you don't get inelastic scattering, but you of course want to simulate this somehow, right? So how do you go on about these.
Yeah, yes. So, so you know, the I think, you know, if you could hold on to that question and that thought until the end of the talk, right. And if I still don't answer it, then you ask me again, please. Okay. So the idea here is truly that, you know, that we look at integrable models which have factorized scattering, and then we add circuit elements which really perturb away from this integrable point. I promise you this will be answered. So if not, please ask again.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And what is what is really nice about these quantum circuits is that they also provide lattice models for numerical simulations. And this allows us to then probe questions about these quantum field theories. While these quantum field theories have existed for decades, but many of their entanglement properties are being discovered right now. And at the same time, because we are able to accurately model realistic experimental setups with numerics, that also provides a useful hand for our experimental colleagues. To do this, I would like to introduce two more circuit elements. So you remember the capacitor and the Josephson junction. Now the other element that I need is firstly the inductor. So this is just a linear inductor, magnetic flux is phi through it, and the Hamiltonian is phi square over 2L. And finally, I need the mutual inductor, which couples two currents in this way. Now, I'm sure you know the first three circuit elements from classical electromagnetism, but let me just emphasize that these are now objects which couple quantum operators. So phi, q, i's, these are all quantum operators. They have commutation relations. So with this, now we can write down the building blocks for our quantum circuit lattices. The magnetic flux at a point in space-time will be the bosonic field phi. The magnetic energy stored in an inductor will be the potential energy term dx phi squared or phi squared. The charging energy of a capacitor will give rise to a kinetic energy term dt phi squared or an interaction dt phi 1, dt phi 2. The energy in a mutual inductor will give rise to an interaction dx phi 1, dx phi 2. And the nonlinearity of the Josephson junction will be the source of the nonlinear interaction cos phi. Now, as you can imagine, this is not an exhaustive list. There is no sign of any fermionic mode here, and we could potentially include fermions using Majorana zero modes in these superconducting setups. However, these modes are still being unambiguously established, and so for now, we will stick to bosonic theories, which where circuit elements currently exist in the lab. And for the talk, I want to go from the free quantum field theory of a massless boson. This is the circuit that I had shown you, analyze some of its properties, then go to the integrable models, where I want to talk about the quantum Sine-Gordon model, which is both classically and quantum mechanically integrable. Then I have another model that I worked on, and it's something that also can be realized with quantum circuits. I think I won't have time today to talk about that, but do ask me afterwards. Just want to flash the statement that this model, it's a more non-trivial model, which can be purely quantum mechanically integrable. What that means is that a classical soliton wave packet, when it propagates through this non-linear medium, gets scrambled, but a true quantum soliton, due to the presence of quantum fluctuations, propagates undistorted. And this is something that happens in multi-bosonic field scenarios. And this model can be realized in a controlled manner with superconducting circuits.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Just to go back to the degrees of freedom. So now we are considering an integrable model, but an integrable model is completely factorized. After a proper canonical transformation or unitary transformation in the quantum case, you separate the variables, right? So in that case, you will solve a n-dimensional problem where n is finite, is given just by one particle or one spin degrees of freedoms. So isn't it very different than the story when you start adding perturbation?
The story becomes much more complicated when you add perturbations, right? But the basic idea that you start off with a big Hilbert space and then you manipulate states in that Hilbert space is true. right? This canonical transformation into action angle variables, it's a very pedantic statement. Realistically, you know, I take the Heisenberg spin chain. And if you take the XXZ spin chain or the XYZ spin chain, if you want to solve it, you solve it with the algebraic beta ansatz. Nobody does this.
No, but algebraic beta ansatz is the separation of variable. Because you solve
at a very formal level, yes. I don't quite understand what exactly is the critique here, because so we are looking at interacting models. Integrable models can be interacting. They can factorized scattering can be diagonal, off diagonal. So it's a non-trivial problem. It's not something that can be trivially solved, right? You agree with the statement?
Well, what is non-trivial? I would say it's to find this canonical transformation, but after the canonical transformation, the system is not interacting, right? So I was just wondering if the system that you will now consider, I mean, are too much privileged, and so they get too far from the
I don't quite agree with the statement that they're not interacting. It's not a free fermion model. It's something that scattering has non-trivial phase shifts. You can have internal quantum numbers that can change. So it doesn't even have to be diagonal, right? I mean, so for instance, if you have a degenerate mass spectrum, like let's say you have solitons and anti-solitons, which have the same mass, then it's not even that the scattering is trivial, right? Free fermions are something that truly are trivial in this sense. But even like the scattering matrix of, let's say, models which are non-degenerate mass spectrum, like let's say the transverse field Ising model at criticality with the magnetic perturbation, it exhibits some kind of E8 symmetry, but all the mass multiplets are non-degenerate. So there, again, scattering is relatively trivial. But if you take the Sine-Gordon model, the scattering is absolutely not trivial. There are diagonal points where solitons bounce back in a certain way with anti-solitons, but it's not something that makes the problem trivial at all.
I don't want to say that it probably is trivial when you look at scattering of solitons, but you know that there exists in principle that maybe you cannot find it, maybe it's hard, but there exists a unitary transformation, a canonical transformation, how do you want to call it, that makes the problem non-interacting in the new variables, which will not be real positions and momenta.
No, it's not. Doesn't make it non-interacting. It can still be. It's an interacting integrable model. It's not non-interacting. Let's discuss this at a one-on-one level. Maybe that's better because it's a bit technical for the rest of the audience. So, but the goal here is to go from integrable models to perturbed integrable models. And here I hope to answer the question that Dominic raised, which is how to get to general quantum field theories, because after all, for our goal is not to simulate integrable models. Our goal is to simulate general models. And I'll provide you a recipe of how to realize arbitrary perturbations and give you a specific example of a perturbed Sine-Gordon model. So first I want to tell you a bit about the free theory and some of its entanglement properties. So imagine that you have a one-dimensional system of this circuit, let's say, and in this circuit, you take a block of it, which is of size L, and you have, I call this A, and then the rest of the system is A complement. Now, how would you quantify the entanglement between A and the rest of the system? So one possible candidate is the von Neumann entropy. And because we are looking at zero temperature ground state properties, you can call it the entanglement entropy here. And what was shown is that this entanglement entropy has a logarithmic scaling with subsystem size. And the coefficient of this logarithmic scaling gives you a very fundamental property of this quantum field theory. It's called the central charge. You can think of this as the number of long wavelength degrees of freedom in the system. So for a free real boson, this number is 1. Now you can see that this entanglement entropy, while it captures this very important property of the central charge, it glosses over many other properties. For instance, one can ask the Luttinger parameter, which governs the algebraic decay of correlations, That is clearly a long wavelength property of the system. How can I capture signatures of the Luttinger parameter in the entanglement? Then we can also ask, how would it be how would the entanglement behave if you had boundaries in the system? And finally, can we capture the entire entanglement from an entanglement measure? Can we capture the complete spectrum of the theory? And it turns out that the answers to these questions are available firstly numerically and also analytically. And analytically, it's possible to compute all these things exactly because of some powerful techniques of conformal field theory. So before I show you some results, let me mention to you how to implement boundary conditions in these kind of systems. So imagine that you have now a finite size circuit and you want to impose boundary conditions for this massless scalar theory. So the way to do it is to implement to put in some Josephson injunctions at the boundary. There are two boundary conditions for this massless scalar. There is Dirichlet boundary condition, when the field is pinned to a constant on an average. This can be achieved by setting the junction energy to infinity. And you can also have Neumann boundary conditions when the spatial gradient is zero on an average. And that's when the junction EJ boundary energy, that thing goes to zero. You can think in terms of simple electrical engineering. So phi is the magnetic flux. So time derivative of the magnetic flux is the voltage. So when phi is constant, then the voltage drop is zero. So what that means is that there is a short circuit here. And this is exactly what happens when the Josephson junction energy goes to infinity, because supercurrent can flow directly through the circuit without any resistance. On the other hand, spatial derivative of the flux is just the current. And so when that is zero, that means that there is an open circuit. And this is exactly what happens if you would set the Josephson junction energy to zero. So you just delete the junctions from here. You just have an open circuit at the end. Now, why is it interesting? This is interesting because now if you add boundaries to the system, now the entanglement entropy has not only a logarithmic dependence with the effective subsystem size, but also you have a boundary dependent contribution. This contribution depends on the Luttinger parameter. And so what we can show is that if you go from one boundary condition to another, then you can compute the change in the boundary entropy, and both numerically and analytically, and this gives an accurate estimate of the Luttinger parameter. And then once we know the existence of boundary entropy, we go even a step further and try to get the complete spectrum from an entanglement measure. And to that end, we consider the entanglement Hamiltonian. So it is simply the log of the reduced density matrix up to some constant. Now you can see that compared to the entanglement entropy, where you sum over all the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix with some weights. Here we are looking at the entire spectrum, so that it contains more information is obvious. It turns out that for these kinds of quantum field theories, the spectrum of the entanglement Hamiltonian actually gives the complete spectrum of the field theory. And this is something that's a very pleasant situation, because this entanglement spectrum of the ground state is something that is accessible with techniques like DMRG. And so it complements exact diagonalization and other truncated conformal space approaches. So I will just sketch the analytical results that we obtained for the change in the boundary entropy and the entanglement spectrum. The problem essentially is the same as computing partition functions of boundary CFTs. Please feel free to ask me if you are interested to know more technical details. But the techniques have been established for a while, so we just compute the boundary states, the Ishibashi states, and then compute the spectrum. So let me give you the results. So here I'm choosing the boundary conditions alpha and alpha on each end, and there is a boundary condition that arises because I make an entanglement cut, which is beta here. So we can compute the entanglement energies for, let's say, Neumann boundary conditions. And this is how they look. So each eigenvalue is indexed by two integers, k and l. K can be both positive and negative, and l is non-negative. And we can compute exactly the zero-point energy, and we can compute also the dependence of this energy eigenvalue on k and l. And we can then relate these eigenvalues to the dimensions of the primary fields in this conformal field theory, and the l's to the descendant level for each primary field. And we can also predict exactly the degeneracies at each level. And so it turns out that the degeneracy is the number of integer partitioning of L. And this also then allows us to compute exactly the change in the boundary entropy as you go from Neumann to Dirichlet boundary conditions. And this change is given to be 1/2 log 2 over K. And now we can, having done this analytical computation, we can then check with our numerical techniques if the results are compatible with our circuit predictions. So I'm giving you now the DMRG results. And on the x-axis is the index k that is given on the right-hand side in blue here. And the y-axis is essentially rescaled entanglement energies, which gives us essentially the index L. The diamonds are the DMRG predictions, rather DMRG results, and the dots are the analytical predictions. And on the right-hand side are the degeneracies for each level that I predicted from analytics. And you can see for the low-lying levels, the agreement is quite good, which shows that we are indeed probing the right regimes. And as you go higher up, the pattern washes away because we have finite truncation. This is a gapless system. And so our truncation errors are substantial for high entanglement energy levels. Let me make a comment here, which is that if you look at each of these towers here, you will see that after the first two, the higher lying levels, they are degenerate. So the degeneracies are given here. And this is a highly non-generic scenario. So for instance, if you would have a generic many-body system, and if you would like to look at the eigenvalue distribution of its reduced density matrix, then you will see that in general, they will have no degeneracies. And this characteristic of this degeneracy is characteristic of an integrable model. And if you were to do level statistics, you will see that this level statistics is Poissonian as opposed to a generic many-body system, which would have random matrix theory predictions of Wigner-Dyson statistics. And here, as you can imagine, this is the signature of integrability is kind of evident, and it's expected because here we are looking at the free theory. And now we can also compute the change in the boundary entropy, and entanglement entropies are very well computed with DMRG again. And here, if I now go from Neumann to Dirichlet boundary conditions, you can see that the entropy does change by an amount, and we can check that this is indeed the predicted amount. And so there is a simple physical understanding of this change. So you see, I've drawn an arrow pointing in one direction. It's because this entropy always goes down. So if you go from Neumann to Dirichlet, so if you simply think about it, if the boundary degrees of freedom are just free to fluctuate, then entropy is higher compared to if you pin them by some potential. That's one way to think about it. And there is something a bit more profound, which is known as the G theorem, which tells you that the entropy under this boundary RG flow always goes down. Okay, so I've shown you some results on the free theory. So now let me move on to the quantum sign Gordon model.
Can I actually ask a real quick question?
Yes.
Might be a bit naive, but I mean, in practice, as far as I know, at least, like people in the lab, so say you wanted to build a system and use measurements to actually do this, you cannot measure Tangman entropy, right? At least that's my understanding. But you would do like Renyi entropies, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I don't know. Like, do you have results for Renyis, or is that essentially technically almost the same to obtain
it? It would be the same. Yes. So the Renyi entropy, actually, the boundary contribution is the same. So if you look at this, this formula, yeah, here. So you know, you see, I wrote C over 6 here. And so, you know, there is a contribution which has n dependence here. So that's the change. The change in the boundary entropy for Renyi and entanglement entropy is the same. But your question is something that's a very good point, which is that as much as we can delightfully compute boundary entanglement entropies with the numerical techniques, this is a big challenge to measure. And especially when the replica index n is 1. And so I don't know of a protocol that would do anything better than n bigger than 1. And this would be something that would be very interesting to understand how we can measure quantities like purity and entanglement entropies without doing the full system tomography, for instance. So this is something that would be a very, very interesting thing to discuss.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, do you have any insight on like at the experimental level? Because I assume like for measuring like say 2 Renyi entropy, you need like 2 copies of your Josephson junctions, and you also need to have them interact in like a particular way. Is that something people know how to do, or?
Well, not for Josephson junctions. So what people know, so there was this experiment that was done in the group of Greiner in Harvard. So they had cold atoms. And so, you know, if you have bosonic atoms, then you can interfere them through beam splitters. So it's one is known as the Hong-Yu-Mandel interference, where you can get 2 copies of these clouds of atoms, interfere them, and then you can get something like the trace of rho square and so on. However, for Josephson junctions, actually nobody has done any entanglement measures, and it would be something very, very interesting to look at, especially if we could look at somehow transport characteristics, you know, because Josephson junctions are radio frequency systems where you shine some microwave tone and then you look at, you know, the response, the as a distribution of frequency. So here it would be very nice to look at some kind of transport characteristic.
All right, thanks. I think also Rob has a question.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. My camera's not working. Sorry. I was just wondering if we go ahead a couple of slides. I mean, you're doing the analytic work for a continuum model, but you're talking about this finite element circuit. When you do the numerics, are the numerics the exact result for this finite element circuit? Or is there a difference between what the numerics are doing and what the circuit would do as well?
So that's a good point. So the thing is, so numerically, I can compute the ground state energy with a certain accuracy, the ground state with a certain accuracy. This is because, if you have a one-dimensional system and which is gapless, in this case, it's a Lattice liquid. And so you need to have, you know, very many virtual states for you to capture the entanglement in the system. And so here, if I have a finite system, it has a certain amount of entanglement and I can raise my number of virtual states to capture them as well as I can, but I don't capture everything. So that's why my numerics is actually not accurate enough to show what the discrete model is doing either.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. But at the low-lying levels, we can say something. Right. The low-lying levels are where I have precision. These levels have converged for the given truncation. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the low-lying levels are then also compatible with the continuum predictions.
Okay. No, I think I understand. Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there other questions? Okay, if not, then I will just go ahead. Okay, so now we come to the Sine-Gordon model. So you can think of this Sine-Gordon model as a perturbation of the free theory. And the perturbation is very special. It is this cosine beta phi. Beta is some kind of coupling constant, and M naught is the interaction strength. And so in the classical limit, we can think of the classical limit as when beta is going to zero. It's just a set of partial differential equations. But these are very special partial differential equations which can be integrated exactly. And so what you can show is that there are traveling wave packet solutions which can propagate through this nonlinear medium without getting scrambled. And when they go through each other, they scatter with phase shifts. And this is absolutely not a generic scenario, as you can imagine, because this is a nonlinear medium. So there will be amplitude dispersion, there'll be frequency dispersion, but miraculously, these two things cancel out. And so there are what are known as solitons, there are anti-solitons, and there are also localized wave packets, which are known as breathers. And somewhat remarkably, the classical integrability actually survives quantum fluctuations. And now the spectrum depends on this parameter beta. So this is the number, the allowed single particle excitations as a function of beta square over 8 pi. And so here you see there are quantized versions of solitons, anti-solitons, and breathers. And then as you go through this number 1/2, then you have only solitons and anti-solitons. And the question is, how do we go from the free boson model to the Syme-Gordon model? So we can start from this circuit that I showed you. This is the circuit of the free boson. And let's imagine that we have chosen parameters such that we are in the free boson part of the phase diagram. Now, in order to go to the Syme-Gordon model, all you have to do is to change the vertical link capacitor to a Josephson junction. So this is all the change that I did. And now you can show that the Syme-Gordon coupling is related to the Luttinger parameter of the free theory in this way. And now there are two Josephson junctions in this each unit cell, and each play a very different role. So the Josephson junction on the horizontal link, you will remember it was also there in the free theory. And this is the thing that gives rise to the quantum regime when beta goes closer to one. And the other Josephson junction on the vertical link gives rise to the Syme-Gordon nonlinearity. And for this circuit, again, we can write down the discretized Hamiltonian. So the first three terms are familiar. So there is the on-site repulsion coming from the capacitor of this Josephson junction. There is nearest neighbor repulsion, which is from the capacitor of this Josephson junction. There is nearest neighbor hopping, which is coming from these Josephson junctions. Cooper pairs are tunneling from one island to another. And now there is a new term. This is the term that gives rise to the Syme-Gordon nonlinearity. And it essentially encodes the tunneling of Cooper pairs from this island down into the ground plane. And while this circuit has never been experimentally realized, I can mention that there have been works on the semi-classical limit of the Syme-Gordon model in long Josephson junctions also experimentally. Having this lattice model, now we can go ahead and analyze it with numerical techniques and check that we are indeed reaching the Syme-Gordon regime. And so here, one of the first things that we can compute is the expectation value of this vertex operator, exponential I beta phi. And so in the continuum limit, we know how it behaves as a function of this coupling constant. And it's the dependence, as you can see, is algebraic. And the coefficient of this dependence, the exponent, gives the beta square over 8 pi, this formula. And so we can compute this and check if we are indeed getting predictions which make sense. So this is on a log-log scale. You see that indeed you have linear dependence. And from the slope, I can get beta square over 8 pi. Now, in order to make sure that I am getting actually things that are correct, so I can then compute for the gapless theory, the Luttinger parameter, and check what I should have expected. And so this is what I expect from my gapless calculations. And so you can see that the predictions are quite close to each other, and which gives us confidence in our computations. And as you can imagine, the Sine-Gordon model is one of these paradigmatic models of an integrable quantum field theory. And so there are lots of predictions that are known. For instance, there is the ground state energy as a function of the mass of the soliton. And here also, we can check our DMRG computations with beta ansatz. And the beta ansatz computation was done by Zamolodchikov in 95. And we did the DMRG here. And here we can see, again, the overlap is very good, which gives us, you know, further confidence in our calculations. And we went also a step further, and we also computed the correlation functions. So these are two-point correlation functions. Here there are no more exact solutions, but we can compute them using form factors. And so the dots are DMRG results, and the solid line is the form factor computation. And you can see that the agreement here is, again, quite reasonable. And so, you know, we are pretty sure that we are probing the Sine-Gordon regime. And I want to emphasize that in this plot, there is no fit parameter. Everything that we needed to we needed, like the field normalization, the velocity of the plasmon or the velocity of light, all of these quantities were computed with DMRG. And then finally, after the correlation functions, we also computed the entanglement spectrum. And so here there is an interesting relationship between the entanglement spectrum of the Sine-Gordon model to the Hamiltonian spectrum of the boundary Sine-Gordon model. And we can predict the degeneracies of this model quite accurately using CFT techniques. And so if you now look at the entanglement energies that are obtained with DMRG, and if you look at the predicted degeneracies, you will see that the low-lying levels are quite close to what we predict. And here, things already start to look not so nice. And this is because of the fact that we have finite truncation again. And we for the higher levels, we anyway do not expect the model to show exactly degenerate levels. And this has to do with the fact that the lattice model is not integrable, but the continuum field theory is. So only low-lying parts of the spectrum are expected to have this degeneracy. And so what we can also do is, and something that that uses some old results on the Baxter spin chain, the XYZ spin chain, and this spin chain then can actually give rise to the Sine-Gordon model in a scaling limit. And from there, we can compute exactly the entanglement spectrum as well. So I'm very happy to tell you more about that if you're interested. But for now, I will just show you one interesting result that I found very, very gratifying, which is to compare how the quantum circuit behaves compared to the XYZ spin chain. So how does the Sine-Gordon model arise in the XYZ spin chain? So this is how you should think about it. So you just have a one-dimensional chain of spin halves. They interact with XX, YY, and ZZ interactions. And the coefficients in front, the coupling strands, are chosen to be in this way. Now, if you bosonize the spin chain correctly, then you will see that the Sine-Gordon operator e to the I beta phi over 2 essentially corresponds to the spin operator sigma plus. And the QFT predictions apply in the regime when the correlation length is larger than the lattice spacing but smaller than the system size. And in fact, there are cold atomic simulators of these XYZ spin chains as well. And so the question that we asked was, how does the lattice model based on quantum circuits behave compared to XYZ spin chain? And to answer this question, you will have to remember that this operator mapping sigma plus to e to the I beta phi over 2, this thing is not an exact mapping. There are correction terms which are important for finite size systems. And so this is where faithful simulation come in, because quantum circuits start from compact bosonic degrees of freedom on the lattice. And so let me show you a simple test of how the two things can behave differently. So this is the quantum circuit. And here I'm showing again the expectation value of exponential I beta phi as a strength of this cosine potential for the Sine-Gordon model. And so you have seen part of this plot actually already when I showed you this linear dependence, but now I'm sweeping over much larger parameter range. So it's like almost six orders of magnitude. And you can see that throughout this almost six orders of magnitude, the quantum circuits has a linear dependence as predicted by the field theory computation. Now, if you look at what happens in the spin chain, if you look at this part of the picture, this is when the strength of the massive term, the cosine potential, strength of that is small, so correlation length is large. So here there is a perfect linear dependence as well, but then as you increase the strength of this massive perturbation, then you start, the correlation length starts diminishing and you start seeing corrections to scaling. And this is where you can see that for the parameters that I'm showing you here, which are experimentally easily accessible, it's quite clear that the quantum circuits have much smaller corrections to scaling. They of course exist in both systems, but in one case they're much smaller than the other. Okay, so this is what I wanted to show you about the quantum Sine-Gordon model. Let me show you and hopefully answer the question about perturbed models. So how would you go about simulating perturbed models? So the idea would be to start with an integrable model and then add a perturbation. So here I'm adding to the Sine-Gordon model a perturbation, which is M naught prime cos 2 beta phi plus delta. And this model has seen some renewed interest in the recent years. You can show that as you increase the strength of M naught over M naught prime, there is an Ising phase transition that occurs. And the question is, how do we realize this with a quantum circuit? So you can start with the circuit of the Sine-Gordon model. So this is the circuit that I already showed you. Now to realize this blue term, all you have to do is to add a new circuit element, which I denote by this star here, which is called a 4E Josephson junction. Now it might seem a bit strange, like what is this 4E thing? So this Josephson junction, it's a special Josephson junction which doesn't allow Cooper pairs to tunnel, but it allows pairs of Cooper pairs to tunnel. And it is actually something that exists already because people have thought about it in the quantum information community in the context of zero pi qubits. So these are here, if you put four Josephson junctions in a ring like this and put a magnetic flux through it, then you would precisely get a cos 2 phi potential, which is what we are looking for. And it's not only that people have made theoretical predictions for it, but also experimentally, an array of such rings had been experimentally demonstrated in 2008. So each of these squares that you see in this picture, this is precisely the ring that is shown above. And just to be clear, this array is not this array. So this array has never been realized experimentally. And currently we are looking at entanglement dynamics. When you evolve in time, how the entanglement changes as you change the different couplings. And here, this approach that if you add a perturbing potential, you have to add a circuit element in parallel. This is something that is quite generic. So you can use more circuit elements and simply give rise to any arbitrary potential. You can think of this like making a Fourier cosine transform. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about how to realize arbitrary models. So as an outlook, maybe I can quickly mention, since I'm at 59 minutes, so let me quickly mention some of the things that we are thinking about. So one of the things that we have been thinking about is how to quantify mixed state entanglement. And one of the most promising candidates is entanglement negativity. And so we are looking at how entanglement negativity would change under RG flows. So if you, we can have, for instance, bulk RG flows or boundary RG flows, and we are quantifying how the entanglement in the mixed states change under these kind of RG flows. Another thing that we are very interested in is to analyze this purely quantum integrable model that I didn't get time to talk about. But here we are thinking about understanding thermalization or the absence of it in these models and looking for entanglement signatures. And I'm working with closely with experimental groups, in particular at Rutgers, where we are starting a collaboration where we are analyzing these, how to realize these models and what we can actually measure, precisely the kind of questions that you were asking about how we can measure, for instance, entanglement entropies or ready entropies. These are the questions that we are precisely trying to understand. And something else that comes up in these circuits quite naturally, which is what is the fate of these field theories when you open them to dissipation? Because when you measure a quantum system, you always open them to dissipation. And so even the basic questions like how would the spectrum of the Sine-Gordon model quantitatively change if you open it to dissipation, it's an open question. And we are interested to understand these questions. So I think I'm past 1 hour, so let me maybe skip the second outlook and get to just thanking my collaborators. So I would like to thank Johannes Hauschild at Berkeley and Frank Pullman in TU Munich, who helped me with the numerical side of the project. And the analytical side was done in collaboration with Hubert Seller in Saclay and Dirk Schulit at Utrecht. Thanks again for listening, and I'm happy to take further questions.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks so much for this nice talk. Yeah, I would suggest, as always, if people have questions, just unmute yourself and shoot. So yeah, Alexandre, you can.
Hi. Would it be possible to measure scattering phase shifts with these quantum circuits?
Well, so you specifically want the phase or the amplitude? So the scattering matrix elements have, as you can imagine, both they are complex numbers, and so to get the phase would require some kind of interference that I don't know off the top of my head right now. But if you would measure, for instance, transport like DC transport or you know spectral functions, these would directly use the scattering matrix amplitudes, for instance. So you know, so the soliton goes in, scatters, and then scatter with the scatter, and then comes back. So this reflection coefficient, it determines essentially how much current is flowing back. And so by measuring transport characteristic, you can directly get the scattering matrix elements. But maybe mod square. That's the point. Yeah. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Okay, well, let me ask a question. So you showed this plot that, say, if you have like an XYZ spin chain, mm-hmm. that you get corrections of scaling like early on for particular parts. Is there like, well, maybe you said it and I just didn't catch it, but is there sort of like a general understanding for why that is? Why, like, are quantum circuits better in general? And is there a
reason
to see that, why that would be, or?
Well, the corrections to scaling for the Heisenberg spin chain is easier to quantify because the model is integrable at the lattice level. So you can actually solve the lattice model for all parameters using beta ansatz. For the quantum circuit model, that's a bit more difficult to quantify because of the fact that the lattice model is not tractable without numerics. However, an intuitive way to think about it is that here, we are starting with, you know, the Hamiltonian has corrections to, so you start with the lattice Hamiltonian. You look at some parameters where it is described by a quantum field theory Hamiltonian, And now this is not an exact mapping, but there are corrections to the quantum field theory Hamiltonian, right? So that's one correction to scaling. But then there is another correction to scaling, which is simply at the level of operators. So the sigma plus here is not even exponential I beta phi over 2. There is stuff here. And the thing is, this is not the case for the leading order term is much closer to the lattice model. In the leading order term in the quantum circuit is much closer to the quantum field theory thing because you start from bosonic lattice degrees of freedom. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. No, that's good. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
But just to be a bit cautious, so these non-universal corrections are a bit difficult to quantify. So I couldn't tell you that it would bend here. It could have bent a bit later. It could have bent a bit earlier also. So, you know, this is where I don't know that answer.
Right. Okay. Any other question?
I wonder, could you say just a few more words on quantum integrability? That seemed like
intriguing. I was very sad that I had to leave this away. But so this is the model. So it's a two-field generalization of the Sine-Gordon model. So there is phi 1 and phi 2, and they interact in this very special way, which is cos alpha 1 phi 1, cos alpha 2 phi 2. Yeah. And so this model goes back to early works. I think the most concrete of them in this domain was first done by Fatev in 96. And so they found out that there were conserved currents that could give rise to factorized scattering. And they identified two manifolds. So there was one manifold when the couplings are equal. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you just decouple into two Sine-Gordon models and the problem is a bit trivial. But there is another case. And this is the case when you can show that the conserved current exists only for the specific choice of alpha 1 square plus alpha 2 square equals 4 pi. And if you now look at the classical differential equations of the equations of motion, then if you do the standard tests of integrability, like either try to construct conserved currents, or you can do what is known as the Panleve test for integrability of partial differential equations, they both fail for this relevant case. Mm. But the quantum model and the quantum current is conserved.
I see. Okay.
And so initially it had been seen in some guys in spinful Luttinger liquids, and we showed that it could arise in quantum circuits. And in fact, for the pure quantum integrable manifold, the analytics was also not done. And so this is what we did, where we showed that we could use the factorized scattering of these solitons of composite fields. So here you see these curly phis are superpositions of these normal phis, which showed up in the action. And you can think of just like electrons have spin and charge, these solitons have these two quantum numbers. And what is remarkable is that these two quantum numbers scatter independently. So it's not only that the solitons are scattering in a factorized manner, but the scattering in each sector is also happening independently. Mm. So this is what I'm showing in this SP1 tensor, SP2. And so then we could compute, you know, the ground state energies at zero and non-zero temperature. So I'm just showing one picture here. You know, so this is the thermodynamic beta ansatz equations that we derived for this model that captures this non-trivial scattering that takes place for this interacting model. Okay. Now, if I may have one more minute, I can show you the circuit. Sure. So
go ahead.
So the circuit is actually quite simple. It is two Sine-Gordon models, which are coupled by dx phi 1, dx phi 2, and dt phi 1, dt phi 2. So we can start from two Sine-Gordon models. So this is, you know, the lower half of the array and the upper half of the array. Now to realize the dx phi 1, dx phi 2 coupling, we put mutual inductors, and dt phi 1, dt phi 2, you put capacitors. And then it also becomes very clear why classical integrability works, because you can show in the classical integrable manifold, you literally just have two uncoupled Sine-Gordon models. So of course, if you send a classical soliton wave packet, it will propagate undistorted. But now the non-trivial thing is, if you now have a quantum integrable manifold and you send this soliton wave packet, it goes in, but it doesn't like the mutual inductor at all. So it gets scrambled. However, if you send a true quantum soliton, it propagates undistorted. And so you can really see signatures of this, you know. So potentially we could really compute. We have computed like thermodynamic quantities. So for instance, like there are singularities in specific heat, which behave in a certain way that are like, you know, direct result of factorized scattering. So if the model was not quantum integrable, it would not work. So this is what we have computed. But we are now working on, you know, transport measurements that we could do with circuits. That we could really, you know, the dream is to somehow, like, so we know how to tune these couplings. So these are tuned by these green Josephson junctions and the M's and the C's. So if you tune them, then at some point, you know, you see some transport characteristic, which is clearly a result of this factorized scattering versus as you move away, it just goes away. So that's what is still, that the transport part is still work in progress.
Can I ask another question sort of at the big picture, and maybe it's not fair, but you know, what I can see is that the problems you're developing are, you know, they're good benchmarks for these circuits. And so it'll help them, you know, make sure that they're building these very precise circuits and they're working the way that they should or they expect. But are there problems or questions that you can ask that you wouldn't be able to answer except by turning to the circuit model, well, going to the lab and
oh, absolutely.
Can you give some examples of where?
Yeah, absolutely. So we don't even have to actually go to non-integrable models. If you look at, you know, time evolution after a quench. So
okay, yeah, that was the other one.
So maybe then this gives me actually to maybe an opportunity to again put the other slide that I skipped.
Okay.
So, you know, this is a scenario where you really have a lot of interest now, and it's quite difficult to track analytically. So we can have a quench situation where we can either quench either of the couplings, where's the mouse? Yeah, so M naught or beta. And this can be achieved by simply tuning the Josephson junction energy. So you will see that I have now replaced a single junction by a loop. And the advantage of this is that you can now put a magnetic flux and use a very standard relation that exists in this community, which is that the Josephson junction energy depends on this loop, the flux that is going through it. And so now the first quench could be done with beta square, which is the quench in the Sine-Gordon coupling. You can go suddenly from the attractive to the repulsive regime, beta square over 8 pi less than half to bigger than half. Or you could actually also quench the mass parameter of the Sine-Gordon model.
Okay.
You can go even further. If you really push the EJ naught over EC naught, you actually can go from Klein-Gordon to Sine-Gordon. So you can actually start with the ground state of the Klein-Gordon model, then you evolve it under Sine-Gordon. And so if you understand the numerics, and the numerics would be done probably with some techniques like, let's say, time-evolved log decimation, which has a scaling of d to the 4, where d is the local Hilbert space dimension. So even if I take a local Hilbert space of 10, it's huge. It's enormous. It's totally intractable because the local entanglement growth is so large that you actually need very high the virtual states in the DM, in the time evolved block decimation have to also increase enormously. So our ability to do time evolution for interacting models is really quite limited numerically. So this would be a clear case where you have to go to the lab.
Okay. Can I ask you though, like you can evolve your circuit, but how would you, like there were, there were discrepancies between the continuum model and the discrete element circuit. And so how would I know how long I can rely on the, you know, the circuit to give me an accurate result in a, like for a quench, I think of that as being something that's going to excite high energy.
Yes. Yeah. So absolutely. So this is a very good point. So, so I don't know the quantitative answer. So the so the question is, you maybe for the others, maybe I can just repeat, which is that the low lying description of the long wavelength description of this circuit is given by this quantum field theory. But so if you start from a much higher energy state, like potentially the Klein-Gordon ground state, then you are no longer described by the quantum field theory. So it's absolutely a good point. And so one has to make sure that we don't go out of the regime of validity. This is true, but I haven't thought about it quantitatively. So, but it would be an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That was very interesting. Mm-hmm.